Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say. Today is the day.
Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. This is hour two for the 3rd of December. Certainly appreciate guests like Brandon Showalter and Adam Carrington joining us on Monday morning. So much news to get to, and their perspectives are always so helpful. And I'm your host for the show, Dr. Peter Kapsner, joined in studio by Rachel Sutton and Paul Perreault. And working through so many of these different news headlines, Paul always stacks my desk with reams of paper, and I'm never quite sure what to get to because there's so many great options. But I appreciated this one in terms of the way police have to adjust the way they protect and serve, even using social media to help people these days, because we see that there was a couple in Times Square, New York, who the man proposed to his girlfriend just after midnight, and she said yes. However, before he could put the ring on her finger, it bounced into a nearby gutter. The couple flagged down a police officer to help them, but they couldn't retrieve it. But the following morning, those officers had not given up. They removed the grate and found the ring, but the couple was nowhere to be found, so they launched a social media campaign to help find the couple. Rachel, you're pretty recently married, and so this probably went awry from the typical Instagram proposal kind of idea. Would this be something for you that if the wedding ring had gotten away like that, you'd just be so appreciative of the police tracking it down and finding you, maybe through Twitter?
Yes, yeah. I mean, and that's just, yeah, that would be scary if you're, and you imagine, you know, for any guy who's proposing, that's just a moment of pure terror from what I understand.
It absolutely is. You get down on that knee and to watch that ring bounce into the gutter, I can't even imagine. I know when a quarter of mine bounces into the gutter, it's horrifying, much less a wedding ring.
Yeah, absolutely.
So some other news that we see, and for those of you that trust the dreams that you have, a Maryland man's lucky dream is paying off. A 52-year-old man from Montgomery County said he had a dream that depicted a lucky symbol. And when he woke up, he felt like he was going to, quote, win big. So he did what we would all do. He went to a convenience store in Bethesda, Maryland, where he bought the winning Max a Million scratch-off ticket. The man says that he plans to use his jackpot to pay off his son's college debt, and he'll put the rest of his money into savings. I would imagine after the college debt, he has about $25 left over to put into savings. And, of course, one more bit of news as we've been talking about Advent. This week is we see that Hanukkah is underway. So for our Jewish friends as well, their 8 days and nights of Hanukkah are underway starting last night at sundown. It's the Jewish wintertime festival of lights celebrated with a nightly menorah lighting, special prayers, and fried food. The holiday also reminds Jews to be a light in the world. It commemorates the rededication of the Holy Temple in Jerusalem and a miraculous military victory. For those of you that know anything about Hanukkah, you know that as the story goes in the Maccabean Revolt, that they were there holding down the temple as it was under attack, and they didn't have enough oil to light the temple during the time that they were under siege. And yet somehow the menorah light stayed lit throughout that entire time despite lack of oil. It was a miraculous victory, and that's what's celebrated to remind our Jewish friends to be light in the world. Those are some of the headlines here on Faith Radio Mornings, and I see that we have Dr. Dan DeWitt up next. He is the dean of Boyce College. An interesting book released about the writings of C.S. Lewis. It was a lesser known book about C.S. Lewis's last reflections on what it means to enter into a rich prayer life with God. So we'll talk with Dan next about how we can enter into prayer and what it means to be in conversation with God. Again, welcome here to hour two of Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings here. It's about 9 minutes past the hour. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and delighted to be joined on the line by Dr. Dan DeWitt, who's the Dean of Boyce College. It's the undergraduate school of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And Dan teaches courses on worldview, philosophy, apologetics, and the like. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Yeah, so before getting into some of the writings of C.S. Lewis and about some of these lesser-known works he did on prayer, that has a compilation and a book just coming out on that, I noticed on your Twitter feed that you had maybe one of my favorite tweets of all time, that football would be a lot more interesting if the players actually were whatever their team name is. If it was real Giants versus real Bears playing right now, that would be epic. It was a big football weekend, Dan. That was a great tweet.
Yes, you know, and I realized afterwards, too, that being from the state of Ohio, our college team, they're the Buckeyes. So we'd be rather boring as a bunch of nuts sitting out on the field. So
are you crying in your coffee this morning, Dan, about the fact that they're left out of the college football playoff, your beloved Buckeyes?
It is just an injustice.
I got to say, in Gopher Country up here in Minnesota, where we never even can sniff the college football playoff like that, our greatest delight was taking out the Wisconsin Badgers and winning that Paul Bunyan axe from our neighbors to the east.
Congrats.
Indeed. Well, love having you on the program. I see that you also teach some courses on C.S. Lewis, and I'd be curious how you got that gig. Is it sort of just an excuse to be able to read Narnia every 6 months or so, or how did you end up teaching courses on C.S. Lewis? What a great opportunity.
You know, I became dean of Boyce College several years ago, and they'd never taught a class there on Lewis. And so I went to the provost at that time, Russell Moore, and asked if I could teach it. And he said yes. And I now actually teach at Cedarville University and lead the Center for Apologetics here. But I still teach that class on C.S. Lewis, not because I'm a scholar or anything like that, but because I've just taught it for a long time and they still let me teach it.
Well, and it has to be so interesting to sort of go through the life and the works of C.S. Lewis. And before we get into his book on prayer, how do we see some of his writings and his work and his thinking evolve from the time that he first sort of burst on the scene to maybe the end of his life? Because he obviously went through a lot with the loss of his wife and took on a lot of the different kinds of thinking of the day. What would you say sort of marked his evolution throughout the course of his life of writing?
Well, you know, his first apologetic book was The Problem of Pain, and that's what the editor for the religious programming at the BBC picked up on and invited Lewis to, you know, give a series of radio talks that became famously Mere Christianity. At the end of his life, he wrote another book on pain, but it was A Grief Observed. And so I think just in that example, we see Lewis's theology and his apologetics becoming more deeply personal as he's experienced it throughout his lifetime.
Well, and then relative to that, in terms of a book like Mere Christianity, it really is a book that I hear referenced as a seminal book in so many people's lives. Kind of remind our listeners of what was sort of the main theme and why that book had such an impact and continues to have such an impact today.
Well, Lewis was trying to help his audience, most of whom he assumed were not Christians, to understand how they could think about Christianity and how we should talk about Christianity in the middle of a time like war. And so Lewis had a very clear apologetic, as he said in his book, The Problem of Pain, that pain is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. And so when people were listening during a time of war, Lewis spoke very directly. But after the war was over, that's when Lewis developed his space trilogy in Narnia and even told Carl F. H. Henry, the founding editor of Christianity Today, that he wasn't writing direct theology anymore. He was trying to sneak in when people were otherwise not listening. He was trying to get their attention.
Dan, what is teaching apologetics like these days in the current landscape where there's so many voices? I know during the time and the era of C.S. Lewis, there just was not as many voices that had access to the public sphere that could make comments on things like war or critically analyze our faith or defend the faith. But today there's so many voices out there. So what do you see in the landscape today in terms of the challenges of working through these apologetic kinds of issues?
Well, I think Lewis still gives us such a great example because we could see in Lewis an apologetic for wartime when people are listening and there's tragedy. So consider post 9/11 and also an apologetic for times of peace. And so in a day that's kind of marked by both war and peace around the world, as more and more people have access to global information, I've found in apologetics, the students are, they're conversant with several of the arguments that otherwise pro and, contra Christianity that otherwise they wouldn't necessarily have access to, but now that they have access to the internet, they're facing some of these challenges even before they get to college. A friend of mine did some research on when atheists in America become atheists, and he found the average age was between 14 and 17, not kind of this, you know, alleged they become atheists in college. They're actually being exposed much earlier.
Boy, and in terms of critical thinking at that age, too, it's pretty tricky to think about 14 to 17-year-olds analyzing their faith in that way when there's just so much of the critical thinking function in the brain hasn't developed by that time.
That's right, and I think they're being hit. And a lot of times they're not prepared for it, and sadly, often their parents aren't prepared for it. And unfortunately, sometimes they're in churches that aren't actually preparing them for these kind of things.
Please say more, because I think, too, that's one of those things that I see in my young people that I teach as well, is that a lot of the sermons these days, they've gotten used to maybe 10 to 13 minutes of sort of a quick hit sermon with some YouTube videos and some good stories. But they come into my classroom and they're so often not even aware of what the conversation could be like around this.
That's right. And we sometimes teach them that the Bible is something we deal with in a certain way at church, and this has a certain place at church, but it really doesn't relate to the broader world. And so we've, I think, sometimes unintentionally taught students to think that the Bible and their faith and the gospel don't really relate to these broader issues they're experiencing at school or on the internet.
And do you see a hunger in your students for the works of C.S. Lewis then, if they haven't been exposed? What kind of reactions do you get as you begin to explore some of his writings?
I think every Christian will say they're a C.S. Lewis fan. And I said the exact same thing as a seminary student. I think in some ways just because it was cool. You know, I love Jesus and coffee and C.S. Lewis. You know, these are that's what's expected of you. But what I realize is they're actually amazed to see it, all the issues Lewis responded to, how timely he is. And so to start introducing them to something more than just The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I've had a great response from students. So every time I teach my class, it quickly reaches its cap. And so there's no shortage of interest in C.S. Lewis. And I think for students, it's because they realize that Lewis was able to live in the world and really love people and know people from various worldviews and not compromise his beliefs. And boy, do we need an example like that today.
All right, well said. That's Dr. Dan DeWitt. We're talking about C.S. Lewis this morning. And Dan, when we come back from break, let's get into this recently released book that you reviewed a bit and talked about a bit on thegospelcoalition.org. And it's titled How to Pray. And it's sort of a conglomeration of various writings that Lewis did on the nature of prayer. Not many people have heard of his writings on this, so I'd love to get your perspective on that next on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings here on the 3rd of December, and we're having an engaging conversation with Dr. Dan DeWitt of Cedarville University, who teaches apologetics and philosophy of worldview, and talking specifically about the life and the legacy of C.S. Lewis. And Dan, we talked quite a bit about some of his well-known works, like Mere Christianity and The Problem of Pain in the first part of our time together, but there is another side of C.S. Lewis's life, late in his life, in which he tried a few different times to cobble together some works on prayer and never really got the entire thing released, but you referenced a new book out that does really bring together his various thoughts on prayer. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, C.S. Lewis received a letter from an American fan who encouraged him to write a book on prayer, and he wrote back and just said, you know, quite resolutely, no, I don't think that is for me. But then later, in correspondence with an Italian priest, and they wrote to each other in Latin, interestingly enough, He said to the priest, please pray for me. I'm trying to write a book on prayer, but he can never quite make it work. And so even at the end of his life, the last book he actually wrote himself was called Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer. So he did accomplish a book on prayer, but it was not really the book that he wanted to write to begin with.
Well, and some of the themes within the book, maybe for at least some people, seem that not necessarily a departure, but there were sort of new avenues of thinking, things that they haven't heard really Lewis write about a bit. So what do we see in some of these writings and the Letters to Malcolm?
Well, in letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer, Malcolm, Lewis published two books that were kind of confused about who the recipient was. One was Letters to an American Lady, and people assumed she was a made-up person because of the way the letters are written. She was actually a real person. Then he wrote another book, Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer. Because of all the details in the letters, people assumed that Malcolm was a real person, and Malcolm wasn't a real person. So for Lewis, this book kind of came together when he put it in the context of a fake conversation with a made-up person. But what Lewis originally wanted to write, what he said to that Italian priest, was a primer on prayer for recent converts. And Letters to Malcolm really doesn't accomplish that.
Well, and what are some of the themes that he does explore in this book relative to what it means to have a life of prayer with God?
In the new book or in Letters to Malcolm?
And, well, in either one. Yeah, obviously, he's got a series of essays and stuff. What do you see some commonality between these essays in terms of his thinking?
Yeah, I think the real advantage, you know, some people have said, why try and compose a new book by C.S. Lewis when he didn't actually, he's not the one who authored it. Well, in one sense, that's true. He didn't compile it. But this new book draws from his correspondence. It draws from lesser known works. It draws from Screwtape letters, Letters to Malcolm, from his other apologetic writing, and it pulls them all together. And each chapter begins with a question about prayer. And then they pull in the pertinent information from Lewis's writing that otherwise, if you wanted to have access to it, you would have to have, you know, on your desk about 40 to 50 books and his letters to start kind of chipping away at what Lewis thought on these different topics. So this book puts in one volume, you have access to all of Lewis's thought on different topics related to prayer.
Well, and obviously his colleague, J.R.R. Tolkien, who wrote the Middle Earth series and developed the whole One Ring, Lord of the Rings trilogy there, found, and you had this quote that you reference in your article, that he found Letters to Malcolm, part of, again, of these essays of Lewis, distressing and in parts horrifying. What was Tolkien seeing in some of this writing that he was so concerned about?
You know, some of that with Tolkien and Lewis, it's hard to know where this is a divide between Anglicanism and Catholicism. And I think some of that, what Tolkien found horrifying, was what Lewis would see as more of the informal nature of prayer, that would be less dependent upon, you know, prayers that are made in the church in a formal way. So I think that that would be some of Tolkien's issues with it. But Tolkien doesn't say much more than the fact that he didn't really care for the book.
Talking with Dr. Dan DeWitt this morning, who's Associate Professor of Applied Theology and Apologetics at Cedarville University. And Dan, I'd be curious, as you talk with your students then a bit about prayer in some of these classes around C.S. Lewis, or your apologetics classes, what do you have students that wonder about sort of what prayer accomplishes and why they should do it? Is it mostly just this idea that we try to discern what God's will is already going to be? Or is there a sense in which prayer really does affect the outcome of certain situations?
That is such, you know, to answer that question, we're going to jump into, as my friend Matt Smethurst has once said, the deep end of the mystery pool. Mm. And so my students do wonder about that. I teach a theology course where we talk about providence and we talk about human responsibility and human free will and exactly how do we make sense of these things. And Lewis was not afraid of talking about these issues. And so Lewis talks about them in Mere Christianity, the idea of free will. But then when Lewis describes his conversion and Surprised by Joy, he says that I was no more looking for God than a mouse looks for a cat. But God was the one who was taking all of the initiative. So we see this tension in Lewis, too, that we recognize God knows everything, but somehow there's this command to pray. And in Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer, and then also in this new book on prayer, you see Lewis trying to wrestle with this tension. We can't give up either ends, God's sovereignty or our responsibility. We have to live with the tension and with the mystery of how all that works.
Yeah, I know some of the stories from the text that we explore in my classes have to do with Moses up talking with God at Sinai, where God is going to wipe out the Israelites and Moses talks with God and then God does something different, or Hezekiah pleading for his life. And so there really is this sense in which, how do we balance the sovereignty of God with human agency actually being able to empower things? Is that some of what you wrestle with in your classes?
Absolutely. If, you know, if God knows everything, then there's no prayer that will add knowledge to God. And there's no outcome that will add knowledge to God. So God already knows. And so how can that even make sense, you know, with a human finite kind of rational approach to it? And what we have to see in Scripture is that both are presented as true in terms of human responsibility and agency and God's sovereignty. And so we can't resolve the tension the way a lot of people try to, which is to remove one end of the spectrum, either God's sovereignty. And we certainly see that in movements like open theism, people who write things like God doesn't know the future. But we also can't get rid of human agency or responsibility. That the apostles didn't preach like that. The biblical writers don't live like that. You mentioned Moses. He's pleading with God as if to change his mind. So how can we understand it? I think we can't. We got better and worse understandings. But we just have to live in obedience to the God who knows everything and who asks us to pray and not be anxious about anything, but pray about everything.
Well, I love your phrase, the deep end of the mystery pool. It certainly feels like we're flailing away on those waters at times in these topics, Dan.
That's right.
So that's before right. I let you run, are you an Advent guy? I see that you posted on Twitter that even your dog got a stocking and that your wife has thought of everything. So are you an Advent guy celebrating Christmas in that way this season?
We are, and I'm preaching right now for a friend of mine whose wife just passed away a couple weeks ago. And I've never preached in a church where they were following kind of the liturgical calendar. So right now in preaching for him, I'm doing that for the first time in kind of a formal preaching way, and I'm really appreciating it.
Well, we certainly appreciate you coming on the program and talking about C.S. Lewis and the nature of prayer and all these different topics. We'd love to have you on again in the future, Dan.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Take a break here for Breakpoint as well as bottom of the hour news. And when we come back for the second half of hour two, I'll be joined by Dr. David Aikman, and we'll talk about Brexit. We'll talk a little bit about the Mueller investigation as well as Aikman's reflections on the life and the legacy of George H.W. Bush. Pretty interesting news out of Israel this morning, where Israeli archaeologists say they found a ring belonging to Pontius Pilate. It was actually found during a late 1960s dig, unearthed in a section of a tomb and palace of the biblical King Herod. Last week, the Times of Israel reported that the ring somehow wasn't examined or cataloged until this year, but it is a ring inscribed with the name Pilate. It's one of those things, if you've been to Jerusalem, you know that it's been destroyed and built and destroyed and built, and they have a lot of digging to do to get down into some of the times of Jesus, but they often find these kinds of artifacts. I find it hard to believe that they missed this one for the last 50 years, though, and it had the name Pilate on it. Last Friday on Faith Radio Mornings, I was joined by Carmen LeBurge, the host of Connecting Faith here as part of the Faith Radio Network. And Carmen was reminding us that during this Christmas season, yes, we celebrate as families, but it's also an opportunity to reimagine and tell people about the nature of Christmas.
So this is an example of, Peter, I think one of the ways that we as Christians can take something that culture gives us, like this is a gift. So receive this as a gift that culture is giving us the opportunity to actually clarify something, to help reclaim the meaning of something, to help point people to a truth beyond that which they currently know. And the only way that that happens is for you and I as Christians to walk out there into the culture and say, hey, look, Disney's already lifting up the reality of Christmas. I mean, it's not Mickey's Merry Holiday Party. And even if it were, I would seize upon that, and I would seize upon the word holiday and talk about what makes the day holy. Like, right? There is a way. If Christians are creative and we're thoughtful and we care about the culture and we care about bringing the gospel to bear, there's a way into these conversations, no matter how reduced the gospel is in sort of the cultural activities of our day.
Love that segment with Carmen last Friday. If you want to catch all of what she had to say about holiday, and we talked quite a bit about Advent as well, you can go to myfaithradio.com, check out last Friday's show, and hear that entire segment with Carmen LeBurge. Well, I see Dr. David Aikman is already on the line with us, and we're going to talk quite a bit about the legacy of George H.W. Bush, as well as Brexit and a really critical vote that will define Britain's future in the European Union.
Michael grew up in a great home. Mom and Dad were both attentive, caring, and wanted the best for him. But when Michael entered high school, their good intentions morphed into something they never intended. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Michael's mom was involved in everything he did. He couldn't make a mistake without his mother jumping in and fixing it. He didn't have to be responsible. His mother covered it all. That led to a crisis when Michael was 16. He completely shut down and resorted to unhealthy behavior just to get his mom off his back. Smothering our sons always backfires. Mom, take a deep breath and begin backing off. Your son will never grow up if he never feels any pain.
Find books and other resources online at parentingtodaysteens.org. That's parentingtodaysteens.org.
My name is Bond, James Bond.
Well, of course, that James Bond reference is a reference to Dr. David Aikman, who joins us from Ireland each Monday to talk about so many of the global headlines from a Christian perspective. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Paul. Very nice to talk to you again.
Always great to be here with you, David. And I know that we see the passing of former President George H.W. Bush. Did in all your years of journalism, did you have an opportunity to ever meet the late president?
I did have an opportunity to meet him. And he struck me. I mean, I only had a basic meeting when he was present at a State Department dinner I attended. But he struck me as a very gracious person, very considerate, and a man of obvious integrity from everything he said and did. And, of course, I covered the role he played in the primary campaign when he had to defend his candidateship for the presidency as the Republican candidate against the then challenger, Pat Robertson. And one of the things that was alleged against Bush that he wasn't born again. And his advisors took a great deal of effort to say, look, this guy does believe in Jesus Christ. He's given his life to the Savior, and he's one of us. And that, I think, really swung the election in South Carolina in favor of Bush as opposed to Pat Robertson.
Well, and certainly we see in so many of the tributes coming from around the world and even some of his political opponents back from the day that he really was well regarded and well thought of as a man of faith, as a man of character, as a man devoted to his family, really quite a legacy left behind.
Yes, I think so. I think he's one of the presidents who will go down as one of the greatest men of integrity in our century, actually.
And in terms of what we see in the political sphere today, it really is a time of a different era. It's hard to believe or see that President Trump and President Bush Jr. would be friends moving forward. But we saw the fact that President Bush Sr. as well as President Clinton were friends after their time in office. And what an interesting but affectionate relationship they seem to share.
That's right. I mean, Bush and Clinton worked on a number of international projects together. And they seem to like each other and respect each other. I think Clinton respected Bush because he realized he was a man of impeccable private morality and integrity. And Bush respected Clinton because he had an incredible knack of communicating with ordinary people what was really important. And those two went together very well.
Talking with Dr. David Aikman this morning, as we do on Monday mornings on Faith Radio Morning, just talking about some of the issues from around the globe that impact us as believers. And Dr. Aikman, certainly in your neck of the woods here in the next week or so, we're going to see a pretty critical vote relative to Brexit, Britain leaving the European Union. And that can have some reverberating effects for other countries and even other places around the world. So what do we see in this vote coming up here?
Well, the actual vote on the deal that Theresa May agreed to with the EU doesn't come till Monday, but there is going to be very important events this week concerning how much of the legal advice Theresa May received from the Attorney General should be made public. And this is extremely important because there's a so-called backstop deal in the agreement with the EU for Britain to leave, which says if all else fails, in order to prevent a hard border between the Irish Republic, which is of course part of the EU, and Northern Ireland, then the UK would remain indefinitely in some sort of legal agreement to be part of the EU discriminatory process against other trading partners. So, in effect, it's not just the Brexiteers who say this, but the Labour Party. Britain might be completely subservient to all of the EU's trade demands indefinitely unless this deal is voted down. So, she has a lot of things riding on this discussion and this debate this week.
Well, and certainly we see then the risk that Britain would crash out of the European Union without an agreement, and it's referenced to a hard Brexit. What would be some of the implications if there is truly a hard Brexit like that?
Well, the most serious implication is that Britain would not have the same trading relationship it currently has with other countries around the world, which are basically subordinate to its relationship with the EU. If the UK had to renegotiate country by country all of the arrangements that it currently has automatically through the EU, that would be a catastrophically complicated process. And in practical terms, the ports of Dover and other parts of England could have backlot, sort of parking lots for trucks trying to take their produce and goods over to the continent, either on a ferry or through the Channel Tunnel. That would really complicate matters. And the DUP, which is the political party of Northern Ireland that keeps Theresa May in power in the House of Commons, has said flatly it will vote against the proposal for the EU Brexit deal that Theresa May negotiated with the EU. So that's a serious threat to her hold on power.
Well, it certainly is going to be very interesting to watch because, like we said, whatever happens in Britain is going to have effects beyond Britain relative to so many of the relationships in the European Union and beyond. And, David, when we come back from break, let's change the conversation to some things coming out of the G20 summit and some of the economic arrangements between China and President Trump. So lots more to get into with Dr. David Aikman here next on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we're joined by Dr. David Aikman this morning, who covered world affairs for Time Magazine for the better part of 20 years and now has launched and part of launching a new journalistic project called Godspeed Magazine. Again, if you're listening this morning, Godspeed Magazine is a great resource to go find some trusted Christian news. And David, we talked a lot about Britain in the first part of our segment, and I see there are some events coming out of the neighbor to Britain, that being France, and quite a few protests happening in Paris around the country. Any sense of what's happening there relative to these uprisings?
Yes. The French in general, and I'm sure this is true of President Macron, consider this the worst public uprising and demonstrations in French history since 1968, with the Paris demonstrations that led to the ouster of President de Gaulle from power. So Macron is really worried about this, and he should be, because in addition to perfectly reasonable middle-class French people saying the increase in gas prices has absolutely made ordinary life impossible, you have a whole bunch of anarchists and communists and far-left and far-right people who are taking advantage of the demonstrations to cause real damage. I mean, it's rather similar or analogous to the, I don't know whether you remember, the World Trade riots in Seattle a few years ago when anarchists started smashing shop windows and so forth just to protest what they thought was the excessive control by the G20.
Well, and what do we see moving forward then in France? Because his approval ratings are 20% or lower than that. I don't see too many countries in the world where the leader is that low with their approval rating.
It's true. I mean, he's really sunk a lot since coming into office, and it's really unfortunate. He basically is the representative of the French view of the European Union as a sort of big supranational organization, potentially a future superpower on behalf of Europe for its own. And most French people are not particularly interested in that. They just want to live their lives and avoid too much taxes and too high expenses to pay.
Well, and you referenced a minute ago just a little bit about the G20, and certainly there are some pretty noteworthy headlines that came out of the economic summit between President Trump and the president of China.
That's right. I think Trump went into the G20 meeting knowing that he was going to sit down with Xi Jinping, with whom apparently he has quite good personal chemistry, which is certainly important in international diplomacy. But he's a very tough-minded businessman. And the reason he became a billionaire was because he went into every business deal prepared to pull out his boys or to withdraw his offer if he didn't think something was working out. And in the case of China trade, he's come to the conclusion that China has more to lose in the short run by operating this really unbalanced system of exporting to the U.S. and not importing equivalent quantities into China. And he thinks China has more to lose, and so China will probably cave in to its basic demands for major changes in the trading relationship.
Yeah, it sure seems like President Trump has all the leverage in this relationship in terms of economic viability. We see a very strong economic situation in the United States that isn't as dependent on China, whereas China is quite dependent upon the United States and even some of the European countries to buy their products.
That's right. I mean, China has a sort of symbiotic economic relationship with the United States. They both need each other. I mean, China needs the market. The United States needs the cheap cost of manufactured goods, which it gets by trading with China. But the cost is that American companies that want to do business in China and even set up factories have to surrender so much of their intellectual property to the Chinese that basically they've all revolted en masse and say, look, we've got to change the situation.
Talking to Dr. David Aikman this morning. Dr. Aikman, we have just a couple minutes left, and I'd be curious to get a little update on what's happening in the Saudi Arabia-Yemen conflict. Quite frankly, I didn't know much about this conflict until we saw the death of the journalist Khashoggi, who was killed, and some of the tension from that. But that brought up the broader issue of American support of Saudi Arabia in the war in Yemen, and it's really turning into a mess, isn't it?
Well, yes, of course. The tragedy of this war is that Saudi Arabia, in order to fight the Houthi rebels, who were, of course, supplied and trained by Iran and are a proxy enemy of Saudi Arabia on behalf of Iran, they have bombed massively areas where there were lots of civilians, leading to an absolute humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen. And everybody in the world wants to stop this. The question is, although the Saudis say that they're willing to negotiate, will the Houthis, and by extension, will the Iranians agree to do business? That's what we have to find out.
And so what do we see in the conflict then over the next month or two in terms of some of the conversation between Trump and some of the other world leaders on this?
Well, I think Trump is going to put his support by, you know, to pressure the Iranians really to cause the Houthi rebels to get down to negotiations. I mean, the Houthis deposed a legitimately elected president of Yemen who had to flee the country, and they have been supported by the Iranians completely in ensuring as far as possible that a pro-Iranian regime is on hand in Yemen. And of course, the Saudis absolutely don't want to support that. That's why they got into the bombing and were supported by the U.S., Britain, and several other countries.
Well, so much to get to. I so appreciate your perspective on some of these issues, Dr. Aikman. Look forward to chatting with you again next Monday.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate it.
Take a break and wrap up our show here for Faith Radio Mornings on the 3rd of December. Well, thanks for listening, and happy Advent, and we'll catch you again tomorrow on Faith Radio Mornings.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.